Today, we have two things. One is a briefing on offshore wind energy, and we're very fortunate today to have Dr. Habib Dagher, who many of you know as a real catalyst to change. The composite lab that he runs at the University of Maine is innovative and really has a leadership role in this area. So Dr. Habib, if you're on and ready to go, I'll turn it over to you.
Good morning, John. Thank you for the introduction. Can you all hear me all right? Great. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today. I'm very encouraged to see that many people this week attending this particular forum here. Most everybody's on vacation this week, so this is great. The importance of port facilities to the development of such an industry is key. What I'm hoping today to do is to talk about floating wind, because that's the only option we have in New England. We have deep waters off of our coast, and we're not going to be able to put fixed bottom turbines off of our shores. That'd be too close to shore, and we don't really want to do that. What we'd like to go is go farther offshore, beyond the horizons, and put these floating turbines in a place that people don't see them from land. And so the goal today of this presentation is to tell you what we've been doing on floating wind and where we're heading from a research perspective. I'd like to acknowledge the U.S. Department of Energy, who's funded our research for over a decade right now in floating wind technologies. What does a floating turbine look like? This is an example of the technology we've developed at the University of Maine on floating wind. I'll talk a bit of what it looks like. So a turbine, when you get to be in deep waters over 100, 150 feet of water depth, you have to float the turbine. You can't take the turbine to the seabed. It gets to be too costly to do so. And as you all know, in the Gulf of Maine, we have deep waters. If you're over 3 nautical miles off the coast of Maine, you're definitely over 300 feet of water. So you'd need to float the turbines. Floating wind turbine technology is relatively new. Fixed bottom turbines have been used in Europe since 1991. But floating, there's no commercial floating farm, very large farms yet in Europe. But there are quite a few that are being planned. So this is our particular design for a floating turbine. It's called the Volturnus Hull. The university has 55 patents on this particular technology. But essentially, you need to float a very heavy turbine. In today's turbines are getting bigger and bigger. The most recent announcement was a 14 megawatt turbine that GE announced. Prior to that, there was a 13 megawatt turbine that Siemens has recently announced. So how big are these turbines? They're very big. If you look at a turbine in the 11 to 12 megawatt range, you're looking at each blade being as long as a football field. So these are big blades, big turbines. So to put that in perspective, I'm showing here a floating hull. And to give that a perspective, if you see right here, there's a school bus right where my cursor is. Can you see that school bus? You don't usually find school bus in the Atlantic Ocean, but that gives you a sense of scale, if you wish, of what we're talking about. So if we're going to be building things of this size, we really need to be planning port facilities properly to do so. We don't have port facilities in Maine or New Hampshire today that allow us to deploy these kinds of structures in large volumes. So that's really what needs to happen, is help design facilities like that allow us to put this kind of infrastructure in the water and maintain it. You need maintenance facilities as well to maintain hulls like that. So to have hulls like that, you got to be able to have a place to fabricate the components of the hull. You have to have a place to assemble them and to deploy them and eventually maintain the hulls. It's not just the hulls, but also the mooring systems. So when you have a floating hull like that, to give you a sense of scale, the diameter of each one of these flotation columns is about 40 feet. And the height's 120 feet. So each one of these three flotation columns you see on the corners is like a 12-story building, okay? So these are big, big units that need to be handled and deployed from a facility. Now, the draft of the hull is very important as well. This particular hull drafts about 60 feet when it's out in the ocean, but dockside, it drafts about 25 feet with a tower and turbine on top of it. So when we tow it out to sea, we ballast the hull, so we bring it down when it gets to the final position. Now, because it is a floating hull, you have to moor it, just like you moor a ship. In this case, this particular hull has three mooring lines on it. You can see them here on the corners, 1, 2, and 3. It has three flotation columns as well, 1, 2, and 3 in the corners, and a flotation column in the center that supports the weight of the turbine. Now, these three mooring lines are connected to the seabed to a mooring anchor. And there's different types of anchors out there that we use. The one that we'll be using are drag anchors. I'll talk more about that later. Now, in addition to the hull itself and the tower and the turbine, there's electrical cable. And where does that come from and how do you get it to shore? The electrical cable comes down typically from under the tower, as you see right over here. And because the unit floats, the cable has to follow the units. The unit's actually going to move around in the water as the wind changes direction, as the waves come from different directions, the hull will move. And we call that a watch circle. It moves within the watch circle. Because it has three mooring lines on it, it cannot move a lot. You're talking about 60, 70, 80 feet is the kind of movement you can have in a hull. Now, the cable that connects to the hull, the electric cable, has to follow the hull or you're going to snap the cable. So the cable typically has what we call a buoyancy modules on it. It forms a lazy wave like that. And that's called the dynamic cable because it tends to follow the hull. And eventually the dynamic cables is hooked to the seabed, to an anchor, and typically buried, if you can bury it. These are the components of what a floating turbine looks like. This particular design that we have has been designed so that the hull is made out of concrete. Why? Because you can make it locally. In Maine, in New Hampshire, for example, we can fabricate these hulls locally using local cement or local concrete, using technologies, very similar technologies to building bridges, segmental bridges. The designs are ABS approved, this particular design here. It's been tested in 2013. I'll show you that. And then the estimated cost of electricity when we scale this up to future farms, whether it's in Maine, New Hampshire, or anywhere in the country, you can get down below 6 cents a kilowatt hour, according to a study that's been published by NREL using this particular technology. So it should be cost competitive when we scale up. It's not going to be cost competitive when you do a single unit. It's when you start having the economies of scale and you do a lot of these hulls, then you can drive the cost down. So this presentation, the outline of this presentation is I'll tell you a bit about the center, who we are, what we do. Then I'll tell you about floating turbines. Why do we need floating turbines in our neighborhood? What do they look like? Are there different designs? Do they come in different flavors, if you wish, and shapes? Yes, they do. We'll talk about that. Then I'll tell you about some of the research we've been doing at UMaine to help us develop floating technologies that are valid off our coast, but also throughout the country and the world. And then I'll tell you about next steps. Next steps for our projects is to deploy a single hull, a single unit. It's going to be in a 10 to 12 megawatt range off Monhegan Island. I'll tell you about that project. It's called New England Aquaventus 1. And then I'll open it up to questions at the end. A bit about us. I work at the University of Maine, right in Orono. The research center I work in is called the Advanced Structures and Composites Center. It's the largest university-based research center in the state of Maine. We've been around since 1996, and we've sponsored financially over 2,600 students who've come from 35 different academic majors at UMaine. So students come and work in the lab and get paid to do it, and they get to work together on research projects. We have over 250 people who work in our laboratory, 100,000 square feet, a number of companies spun off the lab, over 10 of them, we've had over 25,000 visitors to this lab. So John and team here, next time you have a meeting, we'd love to host you to our laboratory so you could see firsthand some of the things that are going on. We work with companies and institutions around the world. We have over 500 partners and clients around the world that work with us on research and development, including offshore wind and floating offshore wind. A bit of our facilities and what they look like. Here's an example of how we test wind blades. So if you come to the lab, you'll see some of this. This is a 165-foot long wind blade, which is kind of small for offshore wind right now. As I said earlier, the offshore wind turbines that are currently available today are up to 300 feet long plus. Think about a 300-foot long just blade, okay? And this is a 165-foot blade being tested in our lab. And this is how we test the blades. This is a fiberglass blade with carbon fibers, but you can see the tip of the blade that almost reaches the ceiling as you move it up and down. And that's being actuated by an actuator right at the bottom that moves at the natural frequency of the blade. That's how we can actually move the blade. And we do this for a couple of months to prove out that a blade will last over 20 years. So you don't want a blade out there that's going to snap out in the middle of the ocean and fall on someone, or by that matter on land as well. So this is how we validate new blade designs in our laboratory. Another very important facility we built to help us move floating offshore wind and offshore wind forward is called the Alphonse W. Square Ocean Engineering Laboratory. It's at the University of Maine campus. It's part of our lab. It's a very unique, very, very unique facilities because it's a wave basin, but also a wind tunnel. There are a lot of wave basins out there, and people you've seen them possibly in your lifetime. We do have a wave basin here. It's got these 16 paddles that you see down in there that can work either simultaneously or individually, and we can create waves coming from different directions and different heights, and different frequencies. But what's unique, if you look in the back of this facility, there's a rotatable wind machine. This will create wind storms over the wave basins. By combining winds and waves, we can figure out how these floating turbines, or whether it's ships or supply vessels or whatever, how are they going to survive in that environment? And that's a very common thing when you build a new vessel or you build a new oil and gas rigs, you want to test it in a wave basin. But what's unique now is we've added wind to waves. Now we're calling these wind wave basins. Notice we have a tow carriage as well in this facility that allow us to look at new designs of ships, so forth, and look at the seakeeping capabilities. And this is an example of a floating wind turbine in a 50-year storm, a simulated 50-year storm in the laboratory. So this is the wind machine on the left, and this is, you could see the floating turbine. It's got four flotation columns, three in each corner and one in the center, and they're tied together under the water with three radial beams at 120 degree angles. I'm going to turn on a 50-year storm right now relative to the size of that hull, and you could see how it will move. Can you see it moving at all? Okay, so that's what it would look like in a 50-year storm. And a 50-year storm in the Gulf of Maine roughly has 60-foot waves. That's from peak to trough. That's the typical size of a wave in a 50-year storms. So you have to design for those kinds of environments. How do we know that our design works? We can actually build a model of that design after we've done in a facility like that and try it out under different kinds of environments. And that's what this facility allows us to do. Let's move on and talk about floating offshore wind. When we have deep waters, you really have to float the turbines. You can't put them directly to the seabed. Now, which part of the U.S. do we have the ability to use floating turbines? That's about 60% of the U.S. offshore wind resource within 50 miles is suitable for floating technologies. That means we have waters that are 150 feet or deeper. And if you look here in light blue, the light blue areas are the shallow water areas where you could use fixed turbines. And you've been hearing south of us in Massachusetts and in New Jersey and New York and Rhode Island, they've been planning large farms in 800 megawatt range, but they're all fixed today. They're fixed to the seabed because they're in shallower waters, less than 100 feet of water typically. So they're using monopiles fixed to the seabed to hold up the turbines. But if you look at where we are in Maine and New Hampshire, you see the dark blue areas out there. That's areas that are over 150 feet deep, and you have to float the turbine. You got no choice. And that's why we're focused on developing floating turbine technologies. But are we the only ones that need floating turbines? The answer is no. If you look at, there's a lot of areas that are dark blue here on the East Coast where floating turbines could be used. But also, if you look at the West Coast of the U.S., it's pretty much all dark blue. So if you, just like Maine, the Gulf of Maine, the West Coast really has no choice but to use floating turbines. So developing new floating turbine technologies is now an international race. There's all kinds of designs out there, all kinds of flavors of floating wind technologies. And we're part of that race, developing them for our environments, if you wish, in our manufacturing infrastructure. A bit of when we started looking at floating wind, if you recall, back in 2008-09, when the gasoline and heating oil hit $4 a gallon. You remember those days? Okay, and then of course the fear was that we're going to go back to that. And Maine alone spends about $3.6 to $5.8 billion per year in fossil fuels pricing. That's heating oil, that's gasoline, that's natural gas, and so forth. And all of that money leaves our state. What we estimated back a decade ago, that if we harness just 3% of the offshore wind resource in the Gulf of Maine, we can heat every home in the state and drive every car. Just 3% of the offshore wind resource. What does that mean? If we look at the Gulf of Maine within 50 miles of the shore and let's figure out where that 3% of that area is, if we developed wind farms in 3% of that area, we can heat every home and drive every car. And that's really the potential. Well, are we going to do that? No, not necessarily. But if we head in that direction, we can make a big difference, a big dent in how much fossil fuels we use in the state of Maine, and keep some of these energy dollars in our state. And that's a bit of why we're heading in that direction. But of course, there's a lot of implications in terms of global climate change and the pollution that these burning fossil fuels creates, not just for ourselves, but for our children and grandchildren. So that's why we embarked on this effort 12 years ago. So what do floating turbines look like? They come in different flavors, but there's three different categories of floating turbines. Now, if you're in the maritime world, let's go to a ship. What makes a ship float? Of course, you've got buoyancy, you've got air in the hull that makes it float. And just like a ship, these are essentially floating turbines are ships that have to hold up a 800 ton, 11, 12 megawatt turbines, 350 feet above the water to the hull, and resist all that winds, all the waves. So it's really a fixed ship. A floating turbine is a fixed ship. And you design it almost like a ship for winds and for waves and so on and so forth. So one version of a floating turbine is called the spar buoy. It looks like that. Another version is called the semi-submersible. And a third version is called the tensile neck platform. And these designs have been borrowed from the oil and gas industry. And there's pros and cons for every one of them. Now, the spar buoy is the simplest one to actually fabricate. It's like a big floating tube. So if you took a water bottle and filled it up and put some sand in the bottom of it and put it in the water, what happens to that water bottle? It's going to stand up vertically in the water, right? Okay, and that's essentially a spar. Okay, a spar is like a big, it's like a big water bottle with ballast at the bottom, and that could be metal ballast or other types of ballast. And it's most of the rest of it is filled with air essentially. So you've got ballast at the bottom and air, and to keep it on station, you have mooring lines. In this case, you see three mooring lines to keep that on station. And the other design, the second family of designs, is called a semi-submersible. A semi-submersible is the closest to a ship, if you wish. In this case, you notice there's three different flotation columns on this design. And many of you have seen a catamaran. So when you sail a catamaran, what keeps the catamaran from flipping over? The larger the hull on the catamaran is, the less likely it's going to flip over. And the farther apart you put the hulls, the more stable the cat is, right? Do we agree with that? Okay. Now, this is what I'm showing you here is not a catamaran, it's a trimaran. It's got three hulls, one hull, two hull, and three hulls at 120 degree angles from each other. And what provides the stability is no different than a catamaran, is these three hulls providing buoyancy. And it's called a semi-submersible. Because the hull itself uses the water plane stiffness to keep it stable. Again, a semi-submersible has to be kept on station, just like a hull, a spar does, and it's got three mooring lines in this case on it to keep it on station. So both the spar and the semi have mooring lines on them. The difference between them is that the spar is quite a bit deeper. The spar would have to extend under the water quite a bit more than a semi. In this case, a typical spar might have to extend 250 feet below the water line. So you really can't fabricate that dockside and tow it out to sea because you just don't have port facilities with 250 feet of water, unless you're in the fjords of Norway. And that's the very first spar, not accidentally, that was developed in the world, was developed in Norway and because of the fjords. They actually built it right in a port facility. I'm sure many of you would love to have a port facility with a 500 feet of water dockside, but we just don't have that in our neighborhood. So that spar buoy doesn't make sense for our neighborhood because we don't have 300 feet of water. But the semi does. As I told you earlier, the semi-submersible that we've designed has about 25 feet of draft dockside. So if you go to Searsport, Maine, certainly you've got areas, particularly where it's been dredged, that are 40 feet of water. So it's very easy, actually very doable, to assemble a semi-submersible in Searsport and tow it out to sea from Searsport. So that's an example of where you could do that. The tension leg platform is a third family of designs, and what's different here is it's got also buoyancy. So this area here is a buoyancy module. It's got air in it, and essentially pulling up, it wants to pop out of the water. And you tie it down with vertical tension legs to the seabed, to mooring anchors. And the anchors have uplift capacity. So essentially, the hull wants to pop up above the water because it's full of air. The three tension legs pull it down to keep it from popping up. And that's called a tension leg platform. And these tension legs are carrying a lot of tension. That's what keeps it stable. That's what keeps it from tipping over. It's not the buoyancy of the hull that keeps it from tipping over. It's the tension in the three tension legs that does that. So in the semi-submersible, it's really the buoyancy of the water plane stiffness of each one of these three flotation columns that keeps it from tipping over. In this case, it's not. It's really the three tension legs that form a moment arm that resists the overturning moment from the wind or from the waves. So these are the three different types of families of floating turbines, or pros and cons for each. We looked at all of them for the Gulf of Maine, and we really X'd out this one and that one. This one, because you need 250 feet of draft to assemble it dockside, so forget that option. This one here is a problem because we anchoring is very expensive for these hulls. They're not stable dockside. You have to stabilize them on the way out, and you have to anchor them, and they become stable only after you anchor them. And you need essentially very expensive anchors in the seabed to moor these systems. And considering the geology of the Gulf of Maine, it's very difficult to be able to anchor systems like that in the Gulf. So we're focused on this type of design for those reasons. So how many designs out there? There's actually over 40 designs out there now being proposed by different research groups. And I'm showing you a few of them here, just give you a flavor. But you can break down these designs into these three families I showed you earlier, the spar, the semi-submersible, and the tension leg platform. And so these are different designs out there. I'm not going to bore you with all of them, explain every one of them, and happy to do that in more details in the future. But we've designed something we believe, and that's our design right there. That's the design that we're using. It's called Volturnus. It's made with concrete. It's a semi-submersible for the Gulf of Maine. Can be fabricated locally. So what have we been doing for the last 12 years? Okay, I'm going to summarize that very quickly from a research perspective. Back in May 2013, we launched the first floating hull off the U.S. coast. It was made in our lab. It was made with concrete, and it looked a lot uglier than our hull today. That was version 1.0. We learned a lot from that. And version 1.0, notice, had braces in it. It's got rectangular columns versus circular columns. The tower is right in the center. We launched that from Brewer, Maine, working with Chimbro, in the Penobscot River, and towed it out to sea. And this is how we towed it out down the Penobscot River. I worked with Maine Maritime Academy, and you can all recognize the Maine Maritime Academy tug right over here, and some safety vessels to take it to keep for navigation safety. Towed it down the Penobscot River and moored it off Castine, Maine, in about 80 feet of water. That was a 1-to-8 scale version of our hull design. It was made out of concrete. The hull is made out of concrete. You see the three flotation columns on each corner and the tower right in the center. So we towed it out to sea. Before we got there, we pre-installed three mooring lines, catenary chains with drag anchors. And when we arrived, we hooked it up to the three mooring lines at Castine. And I'll show you that. So this is what it looked like when we arrived at Castine. And this is Dice's Head. Many of you probably have been there. Not too far from Dice's Head is where in Castine is where we moored it. You can see the hull right over there in the corners. And we had three mooring lines. And you could see the buoyed anchors. This is one anchor. This is a second anchor. And that's a third anchor right in there. And we had catenary mooring chains to each anchor. And then we had an undersea cable that we actually had installed before we got the hull over there. And we had it buoyed. So when we got there, we hooked up the cable to the hull and started producing electricity. And we ran that for a year and a half. And we had over 50 sensors on board to measure the motions of that hull. We measured the winds, the waves coming at it, the currents, but also had accelerometers at the nacelle level, on the tower, in the hull, to see how it moves and to see if our computer models really work. And right, if you see it right in that corner there, we put also a floating LIDAR. It's a LIDAR buoy that actually uses a LIDAR, to measure wind speeds at hub height. And that's an issue if you're out in 300 feet of water, you can't put a meteorological tower in the water. That's gonna be an expensive tower. It's gonna cost you $20 million to put a meteorological tower 300 feet in the ocean in water. So we designed and built a floating buoy that we built in our laboratory with a laser on it, the LIDAR, that actually shoots a laser beam up in the air, tracks the motion of airborne particles, and using the Doppler effects, figures out what the wind speed is. And that's what we put out there. And that was a great experiment. It was just like a big laboratory for a year and a half offshore to prove out that this technology actually works. And here's an example of the first storm we saw on there. It was called Winter Storm Electra back in December 15th, 2013. It was a named winter storm. Many of you might remember it. I remember it because I didn't sleep the night before. It was the very first storm the hull actually saw. And you could see here that's snow blown across, and you could see the white caps. That was not an easy storm relative to the size of the hull. Because the hull was 1:8 size, the wave sizes were 50-year waves relative to the size of that hull. You could see him crashing on it, and we've seen one of the flotation columns completely submerge in that storm. But notice you don't see the hull move at all. In a storm like that. And that's really what we designed it to do. We designed it so that its natural frequency is above the wave energy excitation range. And that's what keeps it stable. And so that was a successful experiment that showed that actually we can design these things so they're going to hold up in 50-year storms, and our numerical models work. Because of that experiment back in 2013, and that's some of the data from the experiment, you could see here, one of the flotation columns completely submerged in water. That was in November 2013. And that happened to be a 500-year storm in this case, that relative to the size of the hull. And what you see here is the blue, in blue and red, what our computer predictions showed and what we actually measured for accelerations of the hull. And notice how close we were able to get to the actual measured accelerations in the hull. And what we saw, over a year and a half, we saw 40 storms between 50 and 500-year return periods. And in all cases, the maximum nacelle accelerations was less than 0.2 g, and the maximum heel angle was less than 7 degrees. So that's pretty good. When you got a 500-year storm, you only heel over 7 degrees, okay? And that's really what we tried to design for, and that's what we saw. So we felt pretty good about this design, and because of the success of this experiment, the U.S. Department of Energy said, okay, we're going to give you $40 million, go and build yourself a big one, okay? And that's pretty much where we are now. We're going to go build ourselves a big one, okay? And the goal here is to build a single unit, just one hull. Initially, we started with two hulls, but when we started this project, the Monhegan project, the biggest turbine available was 6 megawatts. And guess what? In the last 5 years, 6 megawatt became obsolete. actually, today, nobody cares about 6 megawatt turbines. Actually, they're not going to produce them anymore. Okay, the industry has scaled up to bigger turbines just over the last 5 years. And as I said today, the biggest turbine has been announced by GE just this last month was 14 megawatts. Think about that. Okay, 14 megawatt turbines. So in this design, we went from 2 6-megawatt to a single turbine in the 10 to 12 megawatt range. We haven't selected the final turbine, but what we believe here in January, February, we'll be announcing the turbine. It'll be in a 10 to 12 megawatt range. So rather than using two hulls, we're going to use a single hull, a single turbine. So instead, 2 6s, one roughly 10 to 12. Okay, that's where we're heading. And the purpose of that, that experiment really is not only to test the design itself, because we feel very good about the design, but really understand the impact of the design on the environment around it, on the birds, on the bats, on the fishing industry. And it's going to be this particular experiment is truly an experiment. You got to crawl before you walk, walk before you run, make sure you don't make mistakes along the way. And that's why we're doing the single turbine. Like, if all goes well, Maine would have the first floating turbine off its coast, if all goes well, in this case. A bit about the hull location, it's 100 meters of water where we're going to be putting the hull. It's going to look just like I'm showing you in the picture. We had two companies that joined us recently and decided to invest $100 million in demonstrating this technology, and that's RWE and Mitsubishi Corporation. RWE is the second largest offshore wind developer in the world, and Mitsubishi, as you know, is the third largest company in Japan. And Mitsubishi owns a company called Diamond Generating Corporation that's been in the U.S. for over 20 years building power plants, and they're also working with us on helping develop this project. The idea, if all goes well, is that we would start construction in 22 and have it operational in 23, fingers crossed, if you wish. Where's the project site? All of you know where Monhegan Island here. I don't think I have to tell you all, but this slide was created for folks who don't know where the state of Maine is. But it's off Monhegan Island. Monhegan is right over there where my cursor is. And it's in state waters, about less than 3 miles off the coast of Monhegan, south of Monhegan Island is where the site is. This site was selected by the state of Maine for doing this kind of testing. I'll move on. That's what the site looks like, the bathymetry looks like. You can see that's the water depth in feet. The hull would likely go in this position where the blue circle is. You can see right next to it, there's 312 feet of water where we're going. The blue line you see right over here is a three-mile line from Monhegan Island, and that's state waters. So if you're inside this blue line, as you all know, you're in state waters. So we're permitting this hull using through the state of Maine DEP, not through the BOEM. If you're outside this blue line, you're in BOEM territory, you'd have to permitted through the BOEM, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. But in this case, it's in state waters. What is the hull? What are the major components of the hull? I've talked a bit about them. I'm going to dig a bit deeper. Our particular hull design has five types of components. It's got what we call a keystone, right? It's number four right at the center. That's where all the members come together. You cast that in concrete, you cast this big concrete pieces and connect the other pieces to it. Number three is a radial arm. There's three of them under the water. Number two are flotation columns. There's three of them on each corner. And number one is a central flotation column. And then number five is a steel 4-foot diameter pipe that ties the tops of the columns together. And by doing so, the wind load is spread over all four columns. So rather than the central column carrying all the wind thrusts on the turbine, we're spreading the load to the four columns, and all the four columns are about are the same size. It makes it easier to build and to fabricate, and that's why we do it that way. And so a little bit more about the hull design itself. I tell everybody it's built like a bridge, except it's upside down. Many of you have seen segmental concrete bridges, and we've built a number of them in our neighborhood. the Sarah Long Bridge between Maine and New Hampshire is a segmental concrete towers that was built a few years ago. So on the left-hand corner, you can see here four columns and the bridge superstructure on top of it, the concrete superstructure. The columns themselves are made in segments, and even the superstructure is made in rectangular segments. So this particular bridge has four piers on the water and then four superstructures in this case. The pier members are basically a bunch of cans. They could be 30 to 40 foot diameter cans, concrete cans, precast, stacked on top of one another in post tensions. And then the superstructure is, instead of hollow circular cans, you have hollow rectangular cans. They're also precast near the site and then post tensioned together to make the structure. Now, if you take that hull and flip it upside down, that bridge, flip it upside down, you get our hull. So our hull is like a bridge, except it's upside down, okay? And that's, and any company that can build concrete bridges like that can build our hull. And that's the beauty of this hull. It can be made locally and keeps the jobs local to Maine and to the region. And that's the reason we're going in that direction. Now, to show you an example, this is what joins us between Maine and New Hampshire. I thought, being a Maine, New Hampshire port team, this bridge joins the two of us. Many of you have seen it going up, the Sierra Long Bridge. And that bridge is made using the same technology that we're building our hull with, okay? And these are the cans, if you wish, that made the towers of the bridge. About half of those cans were cast near the bridge site, and the other half came from another site that was precast to keep up. But I was out there when they were building these things, and they're about 30 feet long and about 25 feet wide, roughly, cans, and about 10 to 15 feet high. But you can pick them up with a crane and stack them on top of one another. And there's holes in each one of these cans to run pre-stressing tendons through the entire stack. And you squeeze the whole stack together. You post tension it. Between the units, there is an adhesive put in. It's an epoxy that keeps it all together. It's very much the same technology we're going to be using to build the hull. So we can do this now in Maine. We know how to do this. Build these hulls using this technology. Initially, we had thought about precasting the hull elements in Brewer's at Chimbrough's facility. But we're looking now at the possibility of precasting these right in Searsport. We've had a conversation with the Maine DOT and just last week, and to look at the possibility of making casting the elements in Searsport. The idea is you would cast the elements, assemble them, and put the hull in the water, then put the tower and turbine on, and tow it out from Searsport. That's what we'd like to do. The specific details are being worked out right now, will be worked out over the next few months of how we would assemble it in Searsport and put it into the water. But it drafts only 25 feet. So the idea here is there's plenty of water depth in the Searsport area to assemble the tower and turbine and tow it out from Searsport to Monhegan. How do you moor it to the seabed? What we're going to do is use what we call drag anchors. And that's what the drag anchors look like. It was like a big plow, essentially. And you can see how big they are. You know, these are big anchors. And it looks like a plow, and you actually drag it along the mud in the seabed, and it embeds itself as you drag it in. And because of the shape of that anchor, you drag it in and it embeds itself. So to give you a sense of what it looks like, where you see the green dot, that's where the hull is. And the three black lines are the mooring lines for the hull. And then there's three black lines, so there's three mooring lines right now. The other white lines are temporary anchors to allow us to install the drag anchors. So don't worry about the white ones for a minute. Look at the black lines. So the black lines are the three mooring lines, and you have three mooring anchors. Each one of these three mooring anchors looks like this, essentially. It's going to be dragged along the seabed in the mud pocket. So we've identified where the mud pockets are. We're going to drag it along the mud pockets, and it'll embed itself, you know, 40, 50 feet into the mud, and you'll have enough tension on it to hold the turbine. And that's, we're going to be testing, of course, the tension on that to make sure that we have the tension strength we need to hold up the turbine. So that's what it would look like. So three anchors and three mooring lines. And the anchors will need to be in the mud pockets. Now, the white lines are temporary anchors we'll be installing to help us install the other anchors. We've done a lot of environmental ecological studies for that site. I'll tell you, this is probably the most studied site in the Gulf of Maine from an environmental ecological perspective. What we've done, we've surveyed everybody who lives under the water and above the water, birds, bats, fish, mammals, and so on and so forth, to understand what the ecology looks like in that spot. So we know exactly who lives there, under the water, above the water. And then when we go out there and tow the turbine out there and install it, we'll be studying over 5 years how the ecology changes. What is the impact of that hull on the birds, on the bats that we have in that environment? What are the impacts on the mooring lines? And so on and so forth. So it's going to be a big ecological experiment in addition to being a hull experiment. The other thing we're going to be working on is very, very important to all of us is working with fishermen in the area. How do you fish around a hull like that? What techniques can you use to fish around it? And that's part of what we're trying to understand. And by working with all of you and the fishermen, the other piece, of course, we'd like to work with all of you. What are the safety requirements around the hull? How far do we have to, how far can we sail around of it? How close can we sail to that particular hull? What kind of ships can sail to it? How do you do search and rescue operations around that hull? So we have a real opportunity, all of us working with all of you, to understand better how to do that when we only have one hull to deal with. Okay, so it's a great opportunity for us to work with all of you, with the U.S. Coast Guard, with the Maine DOT and others and all interested parties to better understand how we deal with safety around a hull, fishing around a hull, recreational activities, and so on and so forth. So to give you a sense of the kind of modeling we do to design a hull like this, to design this hull so far, we've run over 80,000 simulated load cases, and we use the American Bureau of Shipping guide for floating wind turbines. They have a guide for designing these turbines, just like they have guides for designing ships and oil rigs. We've used that guide to design the turbine, and then they will come back and certify that turbine, that ABS will come in and certify that hull, just like they would certify a ship. And I'm just going to show you here some of the numerical models we use. This is on the very top, an ANSYS Aqua potential flow model that shows how the hull actually moves in a 50-year storm. And of course, the mooring anchors have to follow it. And notice there's a watch circle. It's going to move around through a watch circle. And the dynamic cable, the electric cable, has to follow it. And we have to design for that fatigue loading. The hull itself has to be designed for the stresses you would see under this environment. You could see the stress heat map, if you wish, of the stresses in that hull as it moves in a 50-year storm. So these are the kinds of studies that we do to design a hull and make sure it is safe out there in anywhere from operational conditions to 500-year storms in the Gulf of Maine. So, and this is an example I know from a safety perspective, particularly the Coast Guard folks, if you're going to go out there and operate around this particular hull. This is what the dynamic cable looks like that brings the power back to shore. So notice there's a J-tube at the bottom of the hull. So the power comes from the turbine down the tower, and it goes off to the side of the flotation column, down into a J-tube to keep it from stressing the cable here. And then it comes down. Then we have buoyancy modules on it to form an S shape. And then at the seabed, we have a gravity tether that tethers it to the seabed. Then we bring it back to shore. Now, in the Gulf of Maine, one issue from a safety perspective we have to work with is can we bury the cable? Of course, in some places you can, in some places you can't, depending on the geology of the seabed. We have a lot of undersea cables in the Gulf of Maine. They already exist. We know how to work with them. We try to bury them when we can. If you can't bury them, oftentimes you put you cover them with concrete blankets to prevent snagging of the cable. But this is one of the issues that would have to be developed and dealt with from a safety perspective. And then, of course, the dynamic cable, it has to be very well understood from a safety perspective so you don't snag it. And it's out there following the hull. So I'd like to quickly summarize, if you wish, here, where the next steps here. Our goal here is to start in 2022 fabricating this hull, so that in 2023 we can tow it out to Monhegan and moor it, as I showed you, to the seabed. Our goal here is to use this hull as a learning experience for all of us, not just the university, but everybody who has to touch that hull, whether it's the Coast Guard or the main DOT, to figure out how to manage safety around it, how to manage fishing around it, how to see its impact on the environment, the birds, the bats, the fish, and so forth, and learn from that before we do go out and do other experiments like this. So the governor has announced that she would like to do a research array following this, at, say, 10 to 12 turbines, as a kind of another intermediate step before we go out and build anything bigger than that. So it's a cautious approach. Crawl before you walk, walk before you run. If we're going to make any mistakes, let's make them on one unit, not make them on 10 and 100 units. And building that unit is going to help us better understand what port requirements we have to build hulls like that. So we look forward to work with the main DOT and the Coast Guard and others and the Sprague team here to figure out what it takes to assemble one of these things. And if we're going to be assembling more of them in the future, what would it take for a facility to allow us to assemble them? In Europe right now, they'd like to build in the fixed bottom world, they'd like to build one hull per week, one unit per week. They have what we call jacket structures in intermediate water depth, and they'd like to create a jacket every week. So what does a port facility look like that can create one hull of one of these hulls every week? Okay, as you might imagine, it's not a simple port facilities question, but the opportunity here, if we did this, is to potentially create hundreds, if not over 1,000 jobs in a facility like this that can create multiple hulls. But again, we're not there yet. We have a lot of learning to do between now and then. And the first step is let's get one hull out there and learn a lot from it and look forward to work with all of you. And happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you so much, Dr.